and welcome to the Turkish History Podcast. Episode 44, The Pyramid of Bones. Before we begin, if you have been enjoying this podcast, I'd like to ask you to please subscribe, rate, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. It would mean a lot to me and would help more people find the podcast. Thank you for listening. So last time, we discussed the plea of Emperor Alexios Komnenos for aid from the West, and how that plea opened up a Pandora's box. Unwittingly, the emperor had summoned not a large mercenary army of professional knights to campaign in Anatolia, but a truly massive host, drawn from across Europe and from all social classes, that was now marching to aid the emperor in a sense, but mostly wanted to retake Jerusalem and the Holy Land. We ended with the motley People's Crusade being packed off to Anatolia by the emperor. This crusade, composed of zealous peasants and commoners from across France and Germany, and led by the priest Peter the Hermit, had caused mayhem in Constantinople, and was now marching east from the Bosphorus with dreams of Jerusalem. And today, we will discuss the very first encounters between the Crusaders and the Muslims, as the Sultanate of Rum musters its forces to confront this new invader from the west. How the People's Crusade would come to meet its end, but also how it would inadvertently pave the way for the future victories of the Crusaders. But before we begin, I'd like to note that the scholarship on the Turkish perspective here is actually quite thin. Most histories of the Crusades, to this very day, are barely concerned at all with what is going to be the central concern of this podcast, namely, the impact of the Crusades on the Turkish political world of Anatolia. Western and Greek historians of the Crusades really care about the relationship between the Crusaders and Constantinople, the conquest of the Levant, and the interactions between Muslims and Christians in the Holy Land. As such, the Turks are usually described as basically dangerous and savage enemies that the Crusaders had to face on their trek towards the Holy Land. Basically, as uncontrollable nomad hordes of savages harassing the Crusaders, and not as prime actors in their own right and with their own political considerations and indeed their own polities. Meanwhile, on the Turkish side, most modern Turkish popular historians have extremely negative views of the Crusaders. They basically paint the Crusaders simply as rapacious and violent religious zealots who invaded Anatolia and unleashed untold destruction on the heroic Turkish defenders who fought a heroic and desperate war for their own survival. Neither of these narratives is particularly helpful, and we are not helped by the paucity of our primary sources. The Western and Byzantine sources, like I said, basically don't really focus on the Turks. Meanwhile, most of the contemporary Muslim sources are similarly focused on the Levant, not Anatolia. And the Muslim sources that do focus on Anatolia were written substantially later, and therefore need to be taken with a grain of salt. So what I'm going to try to do over the coming episodes is navigate these extremely tricky historiographical waters and present a balanced view of the complex interactions between the Crusaders, the Byzantines, and the Turks, and discuss how the invasion of the Crusaders upended Turkish Anatolia, and ultimately led to a new political equilibrium and the consolidation of power by the Sultanate of Rum. Now to begin. As the People's Crusade landed on the Asian shores of the Bosphorus in August 1096, Kılıç Arslan and the leadership of the Sultanate of Rum don't seem to have been overly concerned. News of the arrival of the People's Crusade in Constantinople would have made its way to Iznik relatively quickly, carried by traders and merchants. From there, it reached the ears of the Sultan, who was currently campaigning in central Anatolia. The Arab chronicler, Ibn al-Kalanisi of Damascus, records the following. In this year, there began to arrive a succession of reports that the armies of the Franks had appeared from the direction of the Sea of Constantinople, with forces not to be reckoned for multitude. As these reports followed one upon the other, and spread from mouth to mouth far and wide, the people grew anxious and disturbed in mind. The king, Daud ibn Suleiman ibn Kutalmish, whose domains lay nearest to them, having received confirmation of these statements, set about collecting forces, raising levies, and carrying out the obligations of holy war. Incidentally, it's interesting that al-Kalanisi reports that Daud, not Kılıç Arslan, was the king who organized the response. This is likely because Daud was in Konya, which was closer to Damascus, and Ibn al-Kalanisi therefore conflated the two. But though he set out to organize a response, Kılıç Arslan presumably decided that this ragtag army of zealous peasants wasn't really worth bothering about too much. Because instead of breaking off his campaigns in central Anatolia, he decided to stay there with his troops. Instead, he ordered his vassal İlhan, Alkhanes in Anakomnena's words, to take care of them. We last saw İlhan tangling with Alexios Komnenos, of course. Well, since the return of Kılıç Arslan, he presumably submitted yet again to the Sultanate of Rum. As an interesting side note, Anakomnena reported that after submitting to Alexios, he had converted to Christianity. If this is true, and it very well may not be true, then it would imply that as İlhan flipped back and forth between loyalty to Constantinople and İznik, he swapped religions as required. Perhaps yet another example of the messy nature of the Turkish-Roman frontier world. Though again, we cannot entirely trust Anakomnena's story that he did convert to Christianity. As İlhan Bey gathered together the forces of the Sultanate in the west, the People's Crusade began marching towards İznik. But it appears that after crossing the Bosphorus, Peter the Hermit's leadership over the crusade began to break down. This breakdown of leadership caused the already disorganized and undisciplined crusade to become increasingly fractious, with various ethnic groups splitting off and choosing their own leaders. Naturally, this was accompanied by a breakdown of whatever little discipline the People's Crusade had, and the host became even more violent and rapacious. The Gesta Francorum reports, "After they had crossed over, they did not cease from doing all kinds of evil deeds, burning and devastating homes and churches. Finally, they reached Nicomedia, that is İzmit, where the Langobards and the Germans separated from the Franks because the Franks were bloated with pride." Langobards, or Lombards, the name means long beards, were the descendants of Germans who had conquered much of northern Italy. These German and Lombard crusaders elected one of their own, named Reinald, to be their leader. As the People's Crusade split up into what were essentially different bands of marauding peasants, the different groups started to go different ways, though generally they continued to spread east and south. By early September 1096, a French contingent had made it to İznik, which, remember, was incredibly close to both İzmit and Constantinople. According to Anakomnena, Peter the Hermit was still in control of this group of crusaders, though his actual authority was probably slipping as the crusade continued. Now, İznik was a great walled city. It sits on the very edge of the Lake of İznik, with one wall running into the water of the lake itself, while the land walls encircle and protect the city on the other sides. And there was no way that this increasingly disorganized People's Crusade was ever going to take it. Unable to really attack the city, the mass of untrained French peasants instead began to maraud the suburbs. As the French fanned out around the city of İznik itself, the German and Lombard forces continued on to occupy a fortress that Anna Komnena names as Kerygordos. The Crusader historian, Albert of Aix, reports that it was a mere 3 miles from İznik, but we really don't know its exact location. This fortress sat on top of a hill, and had almost certainly originally been built by the Romans before its occupation by the Sultanate of Rum. When the German and Lombard contingent reached the fortress of Kerygordos, they found it empty of people, but full of supplies. Enough grain and wine and meat, and all other good things in abundance, in the words of the Gesta Francorum. Likely, the Turkish forces garrisoning the fortress had quickly evacuated upon hearing of the approach of thousands of crusaders. Meanwhile, İlhan Bey had pulled together the forces of the Sultanate in the region and marched towards Kerygordos. Led by İlhan, the Turkish army rode up to the fortress itself. The crusaders inside, who remember, were basically inexperienced peasants, decided to try a sortie. And it went just about as well as you would expect a battle out in the open between nomad horse archers and unskilled peasants to go. The Gesta Francorum reports, "Now in front of the gates of the castle was a well, and at the foot of the castle was a living spring, near which Reynald came and laid an ambush for the Turks. But when the Turks arrived on the day dedicated to Saint Michael, that is September 29th, 1096, they discovered Reynald and those that were with him, and the Turks slaughtered many of them. The rest fled into the castle." The Turks then put Kerygordos to siege, and the besieged crusaders found that while the fortress was full of wine and meat and grain, it actually didn't have any water. Probably something that professional soldiers would have considered before occupying a fortress. And now, of course, the Turks had encircled the fortress and cut off any access that the besieged might have had to the water outside. Human beings can survive for only 3 days without water, so the crusaders were now in a very tricky position. The Gesta Francorum reports, "So terribly did our men suffer from thirst that they cut open the veins of their horses and donkeys and drank the blood. Others lowered their belts and rags down into the cesspits and squeezed the liquid into their mouths. And others urinated into cupped hands of companions and drank it up. And still others dug into the damp earth, and laying down upon their backs, piled up the earth upon their chests, so parched were they from thirst." This lasted for 8 days, which is both an extremely short amount of time for a siege and an extremely long amount of time for several thousand people to be in a cramped fortress without water. Eventually, the leader of the crusaders in the fortress of Kerygordos, Reynald, decided to save himself. He appears to have secretly made a pact with İlhan, and feigning an attack against the Turks, rode out with his companions and turned himself over. Reynald was allowed to go free, as the Turks captured his companions and took the fortress basically without a fight. The Gesta Francorum reports that those who refused to convert to Islam were killed, which seems extremely unlikely, and it says that the captured crusaders were divided up like sheep, which seems extremely likely. When it comes to captives of war, Turks generally preferred slaves to corpses. The Turks took their new captives with them, and some were reportedly taken away as far afield as Khorasan. With the German and Lombard force in Kerygordos thus dealt with, Ilhan turned the forces of the Sultanate to deal with the French crusaders marauding around the environs of Iznik. And this went just about how you would expect. Who do you think is going to come out on top here? A bunch of disorganized bands of French peasants, loosely led by a zealous priest who was far away, or the Turkish horse archers of the armies of the Sultanate of Rum, led by Ilhan Bey? I mean, it's not even really a fight. Anna Komnena writes that Ilhan placed ambushes in the suitable spots so that any coming from the camp in the direction of Nicaea would fall into them unexpectedly and be killed. As Ilhan's forces picked off groups of straggling Franks, the area around Iznik itself seems to have been cleared of Crusader forces, and the bulk of the Crusader forces coalesced in the fortress of Kivatos, named Sivetot by the Western sources. This was a small fortress to the north of Iznik, near the town of Helenopolis, modern-day Altınova, on the Yalova Peninsula. It was near to the shores of the Gulf of Izmit, and on the other side of the mountains from Iznik itself. There, Peter the Hermit sat with his people's crusaders, though his authority seems to have been slipping even further. The Gesta Francorum records that Peter the Hermit, not long before, had returned to Constantinople, since he could not control such a diverse mass of men who did not want to obey him or heed his words. Now, this diverges a bit from Anna Komnena's account, as she does not put Peter the Hermit in Constantinople at this time. But the reference to his being unable to control the crusade is very telling. If he did go to Constantinople, it is likely that he was hoping to get further supplies from the emperor before pushing forward, and then eventually returned. Remember that the coast of Yalova is extremely close to Constantinople. Indeed, the mountains that rise up on the peninsula and separate Kivatos from Iznik are visible from the great city, and the peninsula is just a couple hours by sail, depending on the wind. With the crusaders in Kivatos becoming increasingly disorganized, and with Peter the Hermit's control steadily weakening, Ilhan employed a devious trick to get the crusaders out of the fortress where they could be more easily destroyed. Turkish horse archers always prefer fighting the enemy in the field to besieging a castle. In the words of Anna Komnena, he sent for two active-minded men and ordered them to go to Peter the Hermit's camp and proclaim there that the Normans had gained possession of Nicaea and were now dividing everything in it. When the report was circulated among Peter's followers, it upset them terribly. Directly, they heard the words partition and money, and started in a disorderly crowd along the road to Nicaea, all but unmindful of their military experience and the discipline which is essential for those starting out to battle. For as I remarked above, the Latin race is always very fond of money, but more especially when it is bent on raiding a country. It then loses its reason and gets beyond control. And I'd like to flag just two interesting things about Anna's passage. The first is that the two active-minded men presumably were not Turks. Turks would have been recognized by the Crusaders, and of course killed or just not believed. This means that they may well have been local Greeks in the service of the Sultanate. Yet another example of the messy frontier nature of Anatolia at this time. And the second is to note the disparaging way that Anna Komnena discusses the Latins. In our last episode, we heard her refer to them as barbarians, and this was the basic view of the Byzantines at the time. The Latins were seen as uncivilized brutes, as barbarians. They just happened to be necessary barbarians. And this tension between the Byzantines and the Latins is of course going to continue, and it's eventually going to boil over. Now, leaving aside Anna's kind of racist description of the greed of the Western Europeans, this was a great strategy on Ilhan's part. Even though Western Europeans are obviously not genetically disposed to greed, as Anna Komnena seems to think, the disorganized peasants in Kivatos, of course, took the bait. They were extremely upset and afraid that other crusaders were going to get the loot of Iznik. And so, sometime in October 1096, they rushed out of the castle and in a chaotic mass began streaming down the road to Iznik. Perfect prey for the Turks. The Gesta Francorum relates what happened next. The Turks fell upon them and killed a great number. Some they found asleep, others naked. All these they put to death. Among them was a priest who was celebrating mass, who they made a martyr right on the altar. Those who were able to get away fled to Kivatos, and some threw themselves into the sea. Others hid themselves in the woods and the mountains. And some the Turks chased into the castle, and they heaped up wood to burn them in the castle. The massacre was total. There was simply no way for the untrained peasants, whatever their religious zeal, to withstand the Turks. Exact numbers are of course impossible to ascertain, but tens of thousands perished, and the People's Crusade was broken. Almost all of the quote-unquote soldiers of the People's Crusade fell, thousands of miles from their homes, in France, Germany, the Low Countries, and Italy. For her part, Anna Komnena says, "As they journeyed in neither ranks nor in squadrons, they fell foul of the Turkish ambuscades near the river Drakon, and perished miserably. And such a large number of Franks and Normans were the victims of the Ishmaelite sword, that when they piled up the corpses of the slaughtered men, which were lying upon either side, they formed, I say, not a very large hill, or a mound, or a peak, but a high mountain, as it were, of a very considerable depth and breadth. So great was the pyramid of bones." Those few survivors straggled back into Altınova. These included Peter the Hermit, assuming he was not already in Constantinople. When news of the destruction of the People's Crusade reached Emperor Alexios Komnenos, he ordered a fleet assembled and put under the command of the great Byzantine general, Constantine Euphorbanus Katakallon. Katakallon sailed to the Yalova Peninsula, whereupon the Turks, harassing the survivors in Altınova, withdrew back through the mountains towards Iznik. Katakallon picked up the shattered remnants of the People's Crusade and ferried them back to Constantinople. Once back in the capital, the recriminations appear to have been thrown back and forth between the survivors and the Byzantines. Anna Komnena writes that her father reproached Peter the Hermit, saying that it was his own thoughtlessness that led to this, and that Peter responded by blaming the others who did not listen to him, but followed their own wills. In other words, blaming the lack of order and discipline of the untrained crusaders. To which I would respond, "Well, what did you think was going to happen? Did you really think that people without any military experience were going to be disciplined and follow orders? Did you really believe that a bunch of untrained peasants were going to succeed in defeating an army of skilled Turkish horse archers? How did you think this was going to play out when you roused these people to take the cross?" In yet another sign of the growing tension between the crusaders and Constantinople, the Gesta Francorum darkly reports, "When the emperor heard that the Turks had dispersed our men in this way, great was his joy. And he gave the order that those who survived could again cross the Arm. And when they came over, he took away all their weapons." And indeed, I think it's fair to assume that Alexios was, all in all, pretty happy with how this turned out. This troublesome People's Crusade was now gone, and its remnants could be disarmed and removed as a threat to Constantinople. I'm sure that the emperor breathed a sigh of relief as the People's Crusade ended exactly as he must have known it would end when he first sent them off over the Bosphorus. Indeed, the total ineptitude of the People's Crusade would come to, inadvertently, be a great boon to both Alexios Komnenos and, ultimately, to the First Crusade itself. In the first place, due to the aid it would give the Emperor of the Romans in his political negotiations with the other Crusaders, and then, far more importantly, in the reaction it provoked in the Sultanate of Rum. But we'll get there soon enough. Firstly, the disorder and the chaos of the People's Crusade, coupled with their catastrophic failure, provided Alexios with rhetorical ammunition to use against the real knights, who would be arriving any day now. And this is a bit of a subtle point, but we need to remember the real cleavage between Constantinople and the Crusaders. Firstly, Alexios wanted hired knights to retake Anatolia, and the Crusaders wanted to take Jerusalem. But secondly, and more importantly, Alexios was desperate to protect his empire from the massive armies that he had summoned. So he wanted to both force the Crusaders to fight for his aims, and to keep them from plundering his capital. This was all the more important to him because one of the key leaders of the Crusades, Bohemund, was a Norman knight who had previously invaded the empire and fought against Constantinople. And so now, he could say to these newly arriving Crusaders basically, look at what happened when your predecessor showed up and didn't listen to me. They plundered my city and then they got destroyed. You need me. You need my help. You need to not run wild. You need to take an oath of fealty to me, pledge loyalty, and promise to restore to me any lands you liberate from the Turks. The defeat and total destruction of the People's Crusade would come to be a great tool for Alexios in his tense alliance and indeed political struggles with the First Crusaders. Thus, as the real Crusaders began to arrive in Constantinople in late 1096 and early 1097, mustering all of his shrewdness and great political skill, Emperor Alexios forced them, one by one, to take this oath. There were many grumbles about this, but ultimately the emperor got his way. Alexios had the supplies they needed, he had the ships they needed, he had the guides and the men who knew Anatolia. Without him, they would be lost. Thus, the Crusader lords were forced to take the oath of fealty. Even Bohemund took it. Anna Komnena reports, the emperor sent for Bohemund and requested him to take the customary oath of the Latins. And he, mindful of his own position, namely, that he was not descended from illustrious ancestors, nor had a great supply of money, and for this reason, not even many troops, but only a very limited number of Frankish retainers, and being moreover by nature ready to swear falsely, yielded readily to the emperor's wish. As winter set in, Emperor Alexios and the Crusader leadership began to plan for the coming campaign. Some of the Crusaders seemed to have wanted Alexios himself to lead the armies, but the emperor demurred. Instead, he provided them with supplies, passage, and intelligence. Anna Komnena says, to them he discoursed of the things likely to befall them on their journey, and he gave them useful advice. He also instructed them in the Turks' usual methods of warfare, and suggested the manner in which they should dispose the army and arrange their ranks, and advised them not to go far in pursuit of the Turks when they fled. Excellent advice, of course. We have seen, over and over again, the effectiveness of the feigned retreat of the Turks. And the Latin knights, with the premium they placed on honor and their love of the charge, were of course extremely vulnerable to this. But Alexios was too canny to leave the Latins entirely to their own devices. Who knew what they might get up to? And so he decided that they would be accompanied by two of his most loyal servants. One was the general Manuel Vutomutes, who had led armies against Ebul Kasım in the late 1080s. The other was, of course, his childhood friend, the Turkish Roman general Tatikios. If you'll recall from a prior episode, Tatikios was a Turk who was captured and enslaved in his youth by Alexios' father while on campaign. He then grew up in the Komnenian household, where he was befriended by a young Alexios. He became a lifelong companion of Alexios and was at Alexios' side as his career skyrocketed. We, of course, last saw Tatikios leading Roman troops against the Sultanate of Rum. Now, Alexios had tasked him to be a translator, guide, liaison officer, and indeed, a sort of spy and agent among the Crusaders. Tatikios and Vutomoutes were to help them navigate Anatolia, but also to keep an eye on them and keep them under control to the best of their abilities. Above all, to advance the interests of Constantinople. As the winter of 1096-1097 went on, the crusading armies thus prepared to march into Anatolia to confront the Turks on their way to Jerusalem. This was to be a huge, and indeed experienced, force of Latin knights, a truly massive Western army of a size and level of skill not seen in Anatolia since the glory days of the Roman Empire. And as we will see, it would turn out that the Turks were completely unprepared for this. See, back in Anatolia, Kılıç Arslan was actually feeling pretty good about the whole thing. The first crusading army, if it could even be called that, had been destroyed with incredible ease. Indeed, he hadn't even needed to break off his campaigns in central Anatolia against the Danishmans. His armies had remained fighting in the east of his domains, as his vassal İlhan Bey had totally wrecked the mass of disorganized peasants that had invaded Anatolia. Kılıç Arslan thought, these were the guys? This was the army that the messengers from the west had warned me about? I mean, come on. And this, ultimately, led to a supreme overconfidence on the part of Kılıç Arslan. As the messengers kept coming, warning of further Western armies gathering in the Roman Empire, Kılıç Arslan essentially blew them off. He was getting continual reports of masses of troops streaming into Constantinople, of a great army being raised in the imperial city. But he basically thought, yeah, whatever. These messengers are being histrionic. I've already seen what the Western so-called armies are like. It doesn't matter how many so-called soldiers they assemble, we're going to totally destroy them. This is going to be yet another bunch of untrained peasants that İlhan Bey is going to have to destroy, massacre, and enslave. I've got bigger things to worry about here, like the Danishmans to my east. I can't be bothered with reports about sheep about to be led to the slaughter. And thus, instead of doing what he should have done, namely, cut a deal with the Danishmans, unite with them against their shared enemy, and begin preparing immediately for a great war, Kılıç Arslan instead continued to campaign in central Anatolia. In the greatest mistake of his life, the Sword Lion did literally no preparation whatsoever for the largest, and indeed the most dangerous invasion his young sultanate had ever seen. His siege of Malatya continued as the bulk of his armies attempted to push the Danishmans out of central Anatolia. Indeed, not only did Kılıç Arslan not send any troops back to the west to fortify and defend what was the heartland of his sultanate, he even left his family and the royal treasury itself back in his capital of İznik. A march of mere days from the massing crusader armies. And the results of this hubris of Kılıç Arslan, of this total dereliction of duty, would of course be completely devastating. Indeed, some of the worst defeats in all of Turkish history. Thus, inadvertently, the total ineptitude of the People's Crusade would come to be one of the greatest advantages of the First Crusade. Because, instead of marching into an Anatolia bristling with Turkish warriors, with horse archers on every road and in every valley, with great armies waiting to defend their homeland, the Crusaders are going to end up marching into a basically completely undefended Anatolia. Indeed, right up to the walls of the capital of the Sultanate of Rum itself. So next time, the crusading army will cross the Bosphorus and begin their great invasion. And the horror of what is happening will finally dawn on Kılıç Arslan as the Sword Lion desperately scrambles to save his sultanate.